Allison Fisher of Public Citizen. Thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's 5 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Also, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM and K220HR in Hood River at 91.9 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Open daily until 5 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550.
It wants to hear from you, our dear listeners and members, about why you support KBOO, why you listen, and why others should support the radio station. Please call 503-231-8032, extension 302, and tell us your name, what KBOO means to you, and why do you continue to support KBOO. Again, that's 503-231-8032, extension 302. Thank you for supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the 10th anniversary of Right to Survive on Thursday, September 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Right to Survive 10th Anniversary Celebration will celebrate the Shelter for All movement, participation of Right to Dream 2, and Right to Survive. There will be a retrospective with short films, slideshows, and speakers on 10 years of Right to Survive's work for safety, dignity, health, and well-being for those without shelter. Again, that's the 10th anniversary of Right to Survive on Thursday, September 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, traffic into and out of Swan Island will be congested after a train struck Going Street Bridge.
Fred Meyer is preparing for the upcoming workers' strike by placing want ads.
And in international news, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has threatened to suspend Parliament over the conflict.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 9th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. And I'm struggling with my microphone here in the studio, so we have a little technical difficulty. The United Food and Commercial Workers Local 555, UFCW, a union that represents Oregon and Washington grocery store employees, voted to authorize a strike 2 weeks ago. The Kroger-owned grocery chain, Fred Meyer, responded by posting advertisements for replacement workers, stating that the company is, quote, accepting applications for replacement workers as a precautionary measure due to a potential labor dispute with the UFCW Local 555, which may occur after September 8, 2019. The ad comes during a long contract negotiation process. Employees have been struggling to gain leverage in the effort to raise wages. The UFCW is outraged by the ad, which offers replacement employees $15 per hour, while the median hourly wage for union employees is $13.50 for women and $17.20 for men. Kelly McAllister, a union spokesperson, told the Portland Mercury that Fred Meyer has jumped the gun, as a strike has not been officially announced yet. McAllister believes it's a tactic to scare union employees. Kevin Schick, an employee at a Fred Meyer in Hillsborough, told K2 News that the ad is a slap in the face.
A Major League Soccer has banned several Portland Timbers fans for flying banners displaying the Iron Front symbol at the team's home game last week against Real Salt Lake. While the Iron Front symbol represents a stance against fascism, racism, and white supremacy, the league claims that it comes under its policy against political signs. One of the banned fans is Abram Goldman Armstrong, the owner of Cider Riot Pub. Cider Riot was at the center of a violent rally on May 1st by the white supremacist group Patriot Prayer, based in Vancouver, Washington. Goldman Armstrong filed a lawsuit for $1 million against five of the Patriot Prayer members involved in that violence. Those five members, including their leader Joey Gibson, were indicted several weeks ago by a Multnomah County grand jury for their role in the violent confrontation. Regarding the ban, Goldman Armstrong said, "I've been a season ticket holder since 2001, and being anti-fascist and anti-racist has been an integral part of the Timbers Army since its inception. We have a multi-ethnic team from all over the world. Support for that team means support for the players both on and off the pitch." Representatives of the Timbers Army plan discussions with the team's front office as well as MLS officials to contest the bans and change the policy.
Up next, we have KBOO's Claire Rosciotto speaking with Cameron Harrington about the Oak Leaf campaign in Northeast Portland.
I spoke to Cameron Harrington, the Living Coley Program Manager, about the Oak Leaf Mobile Home Campaign, which successfully had its opening earlier this summer with new and improved housing.
Sure. In 2016, we learned that the Oak Leaf Mobile Home Park was in danger of being closed down, and the families who lived there were in danger of losing their homes. Many worried that they would become homeless. They had started hearing rumors from the manager of the mobile home park that the park would be sold to a developer who would shut it down and redevelop the property with higher end housing. And so we began meeting with the residents immediately in early 2016. We were able to connect them with legal support from Legal Aid Services of Oregon, and with the help of churches here in the Kelly neighborhood, the neighborhood association, and with people in this community who are organized through Living Kelly, we began a campaign that went on for the better part of that year, 2016, aimed at doing two things. First, we wanted to convince the owner of the Oak Leaf not to sell the park to this developer, and instead sell it to a nonprofit organization that was dedicated to keep it open as a mobile home park. The second goal of that campaign was to get the funding that was needed from the city of Portland and other sources to make that purchase possible.
Right. And about how many residents were affected?
There were, I think, around 30 households in 2016. And somewhere over 60 individual people. There was a variety of older adults and disabled folks living by themselves in some of the homes, and then all the way up to families with 3 and 4 kids.
And I've read about 22 folks will be coming back. Is that about right?
There are 22 homes in the newly renovated Oak Leaf Mobile Home Park. Mm-hmm. The reason that the number of spaces went down is because the park had been developed previously not in compliance with city code. Fortunately, no one had to be removed from the park because of the reduction in spaces. There had been kind of a natural attrition and people moving away for various reasons over the last few years. So there are actually 15 families moving back into the renovated park, and then there will be, I guess, at least 7 homes available for new residents.
Wow. And you mentioned earlier that a number of folks would have been homeless in 2016 had Oak Leaf been sold off to developers. Can you talk about the demographic of folks who typically were living and continue to live at Oak Leaf?
Well, Oak Leaf is very similar to a lot of the manufactured housing communities around the city of Portland. It's a place where, you know, by getting to know people in mobile home parks, the Oak Leaf and others, my organization has found that there are a lot of folks there where this is the first kind of rung on the housing ladder that they've been able to grab onto for folks escaping homelessness, right. People who had been previously homeless and were able to find stable housing in a mobile home park. And a lot of other people who, where this is kind of the last housing they can hang on to and really have legitimate fears of becoming homeless if they were to lose it. So there are a lot of folks who have disabilities, a lot of folks who are older adults who aren't working anymore, who are living on just on Social Security income. There are working families that cannot afford other housing in Portland's housing market right now. And then there are also folks that simply can't afford to buy a home somewhere else, but maybe their family's too big for a one- or two-bedroom apartment, and so they are able to buy a manufactured home in a community like the Oakleaf. So there are really people in a variety of situations, but I think the common denominator is that this is kind of one niche in our broader housing system mm-hmm. that works for people in various situations, but these are people that have a really hard time affording or accessing housing outside of a mobile home park.
Definitely. As a resident, I've been a resident of the Colley neighborhood for about 25 years now, so I can speak to, from when I was growing up there, what Oakleaf generally looked like. Mm-hmm. A lot of the descriptions would not be positive, and I'm speaking for myself and others. Can you, from your own perspective, describe what did Oakleaf look like, and how has that changed now with the renovation?
The Oakleaf had really been neglected for decades. Mm. The previous owner lived in California, was rarely seen at the park. There had been residents who lived there for years and years who had never met her. Mm. And as far as anyone can tell, she was very happy to collect their rent checks every month, but did not invest anything back into the maintenance or upkeep of the park. The majority of the homes at the Oakleaf were actually owned by the park owner, and those should have been her responsibility to maintain them, and that was not happening. The conditions inside the homes were pretty bad in a lot of cases, people living in really unsafe and dangerous situations. And the grounds of the park similarly just were not maintained.
Can you describe in detail what did that sort of...
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Claire Rosciato.
Don't know if you saw those twisty clouds where you were yesterday, but the National Weather Service did issue two tornado warnings for the Portland metropolitan area on Sunday. The first warning was at 6:47 p.m. for Multnomah County's Rock Creek area. That expired 10 minutes later. The second warning came at 7:47 p.m. for South Central Clark County. That one expired after 25 minutes. Strong winds and heavy rain starting late Sunday afternoon closed down several lanes of Interstate 205 by Salmon Creek. High water also slowed down drivers along I-5 north of the Columbia.
Last Saturday, a Union Pacific train derailed and struck Going Streak Bridge. As many commuters discovered this morning on the way to work, there are significant traffic delays in Swan Island. For now, delays could last from weeks to months. Engineers have been examining the damage since the incident and concluded that two beams connecting the bridge have been damaged. The damage has significant impact on the structure of the bridge, which has three connecting parts. Both commuters and businesses will be greatly impacted by heavy congestion in and out of Swan Island, such as FedEx and United Parcel Service.
Ongoing research has shown that marijuana may have many medicinal purposes outside of those best known, like pain relief and glaucoma. KBOO's Althea Billings has more on that story.
Marijuana may be the next frontier in medical treatment, offering benefits for both side effect relief and direct treatment of various ailments. That said, it still faces a lot of stigma and official barriers to widespread use. I spoke to Tracy Ryan, the CEO of the medical marijuana company CannaKids, about what got her started, her work in medical research with marijuana, and what the future may hold for cannabinoids in medicine. Tracy, why don't you tell me about CannaKids? How did it start?
CannaKids originally started about 5.5 years ago now. It was all inspired by my little girl, Sophie. She was diagnosed with a low-grade brain tumor at 8.5 months old. They gave her a 90% survival rate, but said this kind of tumor comes with an 85% recurrence rate. So we knew that the possibility of her being on treatment for a while was very likely, much more likely than us going through one, 13-month protocol and then being done. So we really started looking for holistic options anywhere we could. And we originally were told about medical cannabis. Again, this is like 6 years ago, by some friends overseas. And originally we thought it was absolutely ridiculous. We couldn't imagine giving what we called weed at the time to kids. But then at 9 months old, Sophie took her first dose of cannabis. And it has just been one miraculous happening after another since then that her doctors haven't been able to explain, but have supported since we gave her that first dose when she was 9 months old. We got her oncology team behind us. And now we're actually doing research on her at a top university in Southern California. And now we're starting to really understand why it's been helping her so much over the years. But she was the original inspiration, her and other little kids I was meeting through moms and dads on social media. And, you know, the problem with cancer specifically is that only 3.8% of all government funding actually goes to pediatric cancer research. So I really knew that there needed to be better, medicines brought to market for these kiddos who were otherwise just really suffering. And since we started Canna Kids, we've, you know, worked with over, 10,000 to 15,000 plus patients just that we can count. Doesn't include all the patients that have gone to dispensaries and used our medicine by buying it directly from them. And now we have nurses that support our patients in guided nursing care. And now we have our patients being studied with one of the top research scientists in the field of immunology globally. And the findings we have are incredible. We're actually submitting over 90 pages worth of patents today. So that's how it all began.
Is there a difference in effectiveness for adults and for children?
No, not really. I mean, not that I'm seeing. I mean, pediatric disease can be very different from adult diseases. There's a lot of different types of cancers that only children get. And when you have an autism diagnosis, that's going to be when you're a child. You see a lot of seizure diagnoses in children as well. But across, and of course, you know, you're not going to see a little kid with Parkinson's or MS or fibromyalgia. So there are a lot of different indications. And but the oils that we use are all the same. The only difference is how we combine those products together and in what dosing regimen that it is that they're taking. How many milligrams of oil, how many times a day, what kind of pharmaceuticals are they on as well. That's a big thing that we have to watch out for, because we want to ensure that there's never going to be a drug-drug interaction. We've never seen cannabis become harmful that I've ever witnessed with a patient who's on a pharmaceutical, but the medicines can interfere with effectiveness in, say, like steroids or epilepsy medications. So again, that's why we use nurse-guided care. These nurses are proficient in Western medicine. They understand these different diseases, how they work, what the side effects are, and the medicines that these patients are going to have been given. And they've also been extensively trained in the field of cannabis dosing.
So I understand you've been at a cannabis conference. What can you tell me about that?
I am right now in Portland, Oregon at the Cannabis Science Conference produced by Josh Krosny. This is the biggest medical cannabis conference in the country. I've been involved since its inception, and it is incredible. There are probably close to 3,000 people here right now, some of the brightest minds in the world of both analytics, agriculture, and medicine. And we get to all come together and unite around this plant and present information that we have either learned over the years, or research that we're doing, or techniques and skills that we've developed in this arena. Because unfortunately, you can't go to college and get an education in cannabis. You can't even learn about the endocannabinoid system, even though it is the biggest system in the entire body and is responsible for regulating homeostasis or keeping the body in a perfect balance. So it's conferences like these that allow us to continue to further that education so that we can continue to do our jobs better and grow this industry at a much larger and faster pace.
What challenges do you face as an advocate for the use of cannabis in medical treatment?
You know, the biggest challenges that we've had over the years is, you know, the fact that we're called Canna Kids, and that hasn't been with the community at large. People ask me all the time, how much backlash have you gotten? And we literally have gotten next to none. I can count all the negative comments that we've had on social media literally on one hand, and we've been talking about this plant for well over 6 years now. But it's the governmental bodies that we have challenges with. We had to really fight to keep our name Canna Kids in California, and it was because they deciphered that we were marketing to the parents of children, not children themselves, that we were cleared to do so. But there's a lot of fear with some of these dispensaries and putting us on their shelves because it's illegal to market to children, which makes sense, but it's not illegal to market to the parents of children. So that's been a hurdle. In the scientific world, the biggest hurdle that we are trying to overcome right now is the Schedule I licensing. Cannabis is still a Schedule I narcotic, which means that it has no medical value whatsoever and has a high potential for addiction. And this plant cannot kill you. Like, there's never been a recorded death in the history of man of someone overdosing on cannabis and it taking their life. It's also, you know, something if you take too much of within a few hours, all of that, those issues are going to go away. But there's still so much fear due to all the propaganda and the lies that have been spread since the 1930s when Harry Anslinger and William Randolph Hearst first decided to demonize this plant. We're fighting against 70 years of prohibition. So it's, you know, it's just about making sure that people understand that this isn't just for nausea, not for, you know, glaucoma only, which is what a lot of people think, that it's for pain and nausea and that's it. It's actually much more therapeutic than that. And the government is really standing in our way of researching this plant further. So we are now currently about to start the Schedule I process. We have identified some synthetic cannabinoids that mirror cannabinoids in the cannabis plant that under the Farm Bill we're now going to be able to get into the lab. But it's a real struggle, and patients are suffering. They, you know, are taking toxic medications that affect their organs, that affect how they feel, affect their daily life. And you've got, you know, these refugees, as they call themselves, in illegal states that can't get access at all. And it's really sad.
What is the potential in your mind for cannabis as a medical treatment?
Oh, God. It's almost scary to say, if I'm being honest. And I'm not someone who tries to make claims that aren't founded in things that I have physically seen and witnessed and reported from these families, or you know, I've seen the symptoms relieved from my own child or people around me in my family. This plant has potential unlike anything I have ever seen in all my life, and a lot of the people in the industry really question as to whether or not that's why it's been so hard to study or hasn't been studied, hasn't been legal to study in many years. The drug companies are scared of cannabis because of what it can do when it comes to pain and the lack of need for opioids. It's something that I anticipate in the coming years with research as it evolves, becoming a medicine for many, many, many different ailments in a massive population of patients from infancy all the way to their final chapter of life. And I'm very excited to be a part of it. I'm excited to be doing research on it. And I'm excited to be assisting these patients in their pathway to wellness that isn't going to otherwise cause demise. So I think that we've got a, you know, the train has left the station, as they say at this point. And I think that what we're going to see, especially in the coming years, now that people are kind of figuring out how to get those Schedule Ones and a few of them are being released into the world, I think what we're going to see is going to be quite incredible. And I do believe that cannabis medicine is going to change the way we treat patients.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
Today, 50 U.S. states and territories, excluding California and Alabama, have announced they're opening a broad antitrust investigation into Google, the largely unregulated tech giant controlling the collection and dissemination of a massive amount of data and information. Attorney generals across the nation are concerned that Google has too much power and has monopolized the virtual marketplace. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said in a press conference that the company, quote, dominates all aspects of advertising on the internet and searching on the internet. They dominate the buyer side, the seller side, the auction side, and the video side with YouTube. The bipartisan investigation involves several probes. First, the attorney generals will look into data capture practices, algorithms, and how Google mobilizes user data for advertising. They'll also explore whether the company violates consumer laws. On Friday, Senior Vice President of Google's Global Affairs, Kent Walker, published a blog post stating, "It's of course right that government should have oversight to ensure that all successful companies, including ours, are complying with the law. We have always worked constructively with regulators, and we will continue to do so."
According to a new Washington Post ABC News poll, Americans across party and demographic lines overwhelmingly support expanded background checks for gun buyers, as well as allowing law enforcement to temporarily seize weapons from troubled individuals. The partisan divide in the poll shows up on more far-reaching gun control measures. However, public opinion finds itself firmly behind the Democrats' push for action on gun control in Congress, which reconvened today, by the way. A majority of poll respondents also said they have greater trust in congressional Democrats to handle the nation's gun laws by a margin of 15 points. The poll also found that 86% of Americans support implementing red flag provisions that would allow guns to be taken from people who are judged to be a danger to themselves or others. 89% support expanding federal background checks to cover the loopholes found in private and gun show sales. There was a stark gender divide as well in the results. Over two-thirds of women say they are worried about a mass shooting in their community. That's compared with just more than half of men. Back in February, the House passed two bills expanding federal background checks, and party leaders are pushing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to act on those.
The KABU Evening News. A note for our listeners, the special KABU Board of Directors meeting that had been scheduled for this evening has been canceled due to the inability to confirm a quorum. The next meeting will be the regularly scheduled monthly meeting on the fourth Monday of September. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report, an interview on Harmony Academy, a newly opened high school for students who are recovering from addiction. At 6 o'clock, you'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, 58 degrees and overcast with a 50% chance of showers. Tomorrow's weather, a high of 70 and a low of 57 with scattered thunderstorms. Today in history, Elvis Presley made his first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. The quote of the day is from the king himself.
Well, little darling, I was training to be an electrician, I suppose. I got wired the wrong way, and somewhere along the line, I became a hunk of burning love.
The EPA has introduced a new program to help conserve water in hotels. CurrentCast is the daily newscast devoted to the preservation of our most precious resource, water, and they have more on that story.
The Water Sense Hotel Challenge.
We forgot to tell them.
On this CurrentCast.
Hotels and other lodging businesses account for about 15% of the water used in commercial and institutional facilities around the country.
That's Tara O'Hare of the Environmental Protection Agency. To help hotels conserve, the EPA launched the WaterSense Hotel Challenge, a program that provides best management practices and tools. Some of the recommended techniques include checking the facility for leaks, using drought-resistant landscaping, establishing a towel and linen reuse program, and upgrading shower heads, faucets, and toilets to WaterSense-labeled fixtures. The result is a win all around. By greening their practices, hotels will save green on their water bills. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
The House Judiciary is a House divided on impeachment. On Thursday, the committee will have new procedures for its impeachment inquiry. These new procedures will allow House Judiciary staff extended time to question witnesses and allow evidence concealed from the public in order to protect sources. As OPB reports, this shows a growing divide between progressives pushing for impeachment and moderate Democrats in the House and their leadership, which is opposed to taking any immediate action toward impeaching President Trump. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has notably put her foot on the brakes on impeachment. Despite this, Florida Representative Debbie Mucarcel Powell says, "I think Speaker Pelosi respects Chairman Nadler's work on the committee and think for her, the most important thing is for us to have the strongest hand possible against the president and for the American public to have the whole truth."
For the past 50 days, demonstrators have stayed at Mauna Kea in Hawaii to attempt to prevent the construction of the 30-meter telescope. Now some native Hawaiians have announced they intend to sue the state of Hawaii over the road to Mauna Kea. Antonia Gonzalez has more on this story and others with today's edition of National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Demonstrators have been at Mauna Kea for more than 50 days now to protect the site from construction of the 30-meter telescope. On Saturday, a group of Native Hawaiians say they intend to sue the state of Hawaii over the road to Mauna Kea. Some Hawaiian homeland beneficiaries say trust breaches were committed by the state in the 1960s in land exchanges to build the road. They announced their intent to sue during a press conference. The announcement came a day after the state removed a structure opponents of the telescope built as an educational center. Videos circulated online showing crews taking down the structure and cutting the Hawaiian flag during the removal process. The Department of Hawaiian Homeland said in a statement, "The structure was unpermitted and it took 4 hours to remove. Two people were arrested for obstruction." Demonstrators camped at the Mauna Kea Access Road to stop construction of the telescope in July when crews were slated to start. Many are vowing to stay to protect the area they hold sacred. Human remains from an ancient burial site in Wyoming will be returned to a tribe following National Park Service consultations. The Associated Press reports the remains were removed in the 1960s from the National Forest during an excavation. The remains will likely be returned to a tribe in Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, or Idaho. The Oglala Sioux Tribal Council last week passed a hate crime measure to protect LGBTQ people from discrimination on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. It follows recent legislation which legalized same-sex marriage for the tribe. Advocates of the law gave presentations to each of the 9 districts to get community feedback. China Lockett spoke with one of the proponents over the summer about the ordinance.
Monique, or Muffy, Musso has a mission. She wants community members to show support for a tribal hate crime measure.
There should be not any embarrassment of who you are as a person and who you want to be with and who you're attracted to or who you would like to kiss and who you fall in love with.
Musso says this ordinance is critical to LGBT people's safety.
There's just been too much violence concerning closed minds about two-spirited, about lesbians, about gays, about bisexuals, about trans persons, are about queers having a place within our tribal system.
Musso says two-spirited people, an encompassing term for LGBT individuals, have had a place in Lakota culture for a long time. She says in some Native tradition, they were seen as sacred and even held leadership roles. However, Musso says that changed when European immigrants introduced Christianity. She says these hate crime amendments are a step in realigning the LGBT community with the culture.
And it is imperative that us as people get along and remember that this next law that's coming is for protections.
For National Native News, I'm China Lockett.
The Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians has joined environmental groups opposing a natural gas-fired power plant in Superior, Wisconsin, the State Journal reports. The tribe is concerned the plant would damage the environment. Supporters say it's needed to allow for a move away from coal-fired generation. Some state lawmakers and local leaders are reportedly in favor of the project. Regulators have been accepting public comment on the project. Hearings are expected to take place next month. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The last advisory for Hurricane Dorian was announced by the U.S. National Hurricane Center, and Dorian's officially out to sea. Dorian became a hurricane on August 28th and first hit the Virgin Islands, causing damage to the northern Bahamas. Bahamian relief efforts gained much media attention as the storm reached a Category 5. Dorian briefly made landfall over North Carolina's Outer Banks as it moved up the U.S. seaboard on its way to Canada. Dorian's worst damage in the U.S. appeared to be on Ocracoke Island, which is accessible only by boat or air on a good day. Although Dorian was a far weaker storm by the time it reached the Outer Banks of the U.S., the island's governor reported that 800 people decided to wait out the storm, 200 people were in shelters, and 45,000 without power on Saturday. Dorian made landfall Saturday afternoon in Nova Scotia as a post-tropical cyclone. Hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses lost power in Canada, and restoring power could take days. Farewell to Hurricane Dorian, and hello to an almost full afternoon of rain here in Portland, Oregon. You can view images of the U.S. coast before and after Dorian via the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's NOAA.gov.
Well, it's no surprise climate change is having widespread impacts on the way we live. One effect you might not expect, however, is the impact on young athletes competing in the sun. Dr. Anthony Lazowitz has more on this story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. It's the end of summer, and across the U.S., high school football players are hitting the field for practice. But running drills and heavy pads can be dangerous on hot days. And the risks are growing as the climate warms. Andrew Grunstein of the University of Georgia studies the threat. He says heat stroke can be deadly, so staff must be trained to recognize the symptoms and respond quickly. Coaches can also help prevent an emergency in the first place.
Although the conditions are getting hotter, there's a lot of different things that we can do to protect our players.
For example, making the first few weeks of practice less strenuous.
Over time, your body becomes better at handling the heat, so you don't start with the most intense practice or conditioning drills. You ease into it. For instance, you wouldn't have them wear full pads and equipment if they're football players the first couple of days.
And when the temperature spikes, coaches can limit time outside or schedule practice for a cooler part of the day. Grunstein says these precautions can help young athletes stay safe as the climate warms.
You don't need to stop sports because of this. I just think you need to be more cognizant or aware of the problem so that you can set up good safety policies.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
The British government continues its fight over a no-deal Brexit. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has threatened to suspend Parliament over the conflict. According to UK law, the country will leave the European Union on October 31st, whether or not a withdrawal deal between the UK and EU is negotiated and agreed upon. But new legislation changes that, forcing Johnson to seek a delay to January 31st, 2020, unless a deal or no-deal exit is approved by Parliament by October 19th. Johnson has said he's not looking to break the new law, but he's looking at ways of getting around it. That includes a second push for an early general election. The first attempt was rejected by Parliament. While Johnson claims an election is the only way to break the deadlock in the House of Commons, the Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn said his party was, quote, eager for an election, but as keen as we are, we're not prepared to risk inflicting the disaster of a no-deal Brexit on our communities, our jobs, our services, or indeed our rights. A deal for withdrawal would be designed to ease Britain's transition through trade, customs, and regulatory measures.
A new measure is set to be added to the Multnomah County ballot on November 5th. Measure 26204, if passed, would effectively increase Bull Run watershed protections by restricting access, regulating allowed activities, and limited land uses. That is according to documents from the county. This would add a new charter section and establish a foundation for protecting city lands within the Bull Run watershed closure area, which is the primary drinking water source for residents. Without this passed measure, the charter does not protect the Bull Run watershed. If passed, protections would only be removable by an affirmative vote of Portland residents.
President Trump tweeted this weekend about recently canceled peace talks with the Taliban only a few days before the 18th anniversary of 9/11. One GOP lawmaker voiced his opposition to this proposition. We have that story and more from the Public News Service.
Service daily newscast for Monday, September the 9th, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford.
A GOP lawmaker critical
now of Trump's canceled plans for secret talks with the Taliban. Also on our Monday rundown, health officials in some states stop vaping after possibly related deaths. Topping our news on CNN, a Republican member of the House Armed Services Committee on Sunday assailed President Trump's now-canceled plan to host Taliban leaders at Camp David for secret peace talks around the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Representative Michael Walls of Florida said, "As we head into the anniversary of 9/11, I do not ever want to see these terrorists step foot on U.S. soil, period." Those comments from Walz came just a day after Trump tweeted that he invited Taliban leaders to Camp David for secret peace talks over the weekend, but canceled the meeting after the Taliban took credit for an attack in Kabul that killed a dozen people, including an American soldier. As the number of deaths possibly linked to e-cigarettes climbs, health officials in some states are urging people not to use them. Eric Tegedoff has our report.
State health officials across the country have connected vaping to a mysterious and deadly illness in the past week, and it's prompted the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to recommend folks stay away from these devices. There are no confirmed cases in Montana, although the state is looking into potential incidences. Dr. Greg Holzman is state medical officer for the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services.
We have something that has serious consequences, and we don't know what's exactly going on. Protect yourself and stay away from these products at this time until we have a better understanding, and hopefully this will be a good time to stop using the products completely.
The CDC says it's still unclear which vaping agents are responsible for the severe respiratory illness that has cropped up.
There is a new text messaging resource for young people who want to stop vaping in Montana. It is called My Life, My Quit. The discovery of chemicals linked to cancer, hypertension, and other health problems in groundwater has scientists and some Wisconsin residents calling for more testing. Dale Forbus explains.
PFAS, often referred to as forever chemicals, have been found in the groundwater near the Tyco Fire Products plant. So far this year, scientists have tested 130 private wells in northeastern Wisconsin. They found elevated PFAS levels in 11 and detected the chemicals in 26 others. Jeff Lamont, a retired hydrologist, says the compounds have been found in his well. He says they break down slowly in the environment, stay in your body for the rest of your life, and have been linked to serious medical problems.
Testicular cancer, high cholesterol, pregnancy problems in women, hypertension.
Tyco has proposed expanding the city of Marinette's water system to include more homes that now use well water.
This is PNS. Virginia is just 2 months away from electing a new General Assembly, and this week AARP Virginia is launching a voter engagement program to help candidates and people age 50 and older focus on key issues during the election.
Today begins the program's first event, a two-week push advocating for family caregivers in the state. Natalie Snyder with AARP Virginia says her group is urging candidates to reconsider a family caregiver tax credit that was proposed but not passed during the 2019 General Assembly.
This would advocate for up to $1,000 income tax credit each year. So it would be for qualifying taxpayers. Individuals earning $75,000 a year or less would be able to claim that tax credit for 50% of their out-of-pocket expenses up to that $1,000.
Snyder says more than 1 million Virginians provide unpaid daily living care for a loved one at a cost of $7,000 each year out of pocket. I'm Diane Bernard reporting.
And a potential Oregon ballot initiative would slow the role of automation starting at grocery store checkout lines. Tom Chamberlain with the Oregon AFL-CIO says his group has submitted a measure for approval that would limit the number of self-checkout machines in stores to two.
Not only we need to pass this ballot measure to get on top of automation, we need to establish in this state a task force to look at automation as it relates to job loss and quality of life for Oregonians.
The Northwest Grocery Association says that measure is misguided and customers increasingly prefer self-checkout. Finally, a simple conversation could save a life. That's just one of the messages mental health organizations are hoping to drive home during National Suicide Prevention Week that runs through Saturday.
During National Suicide Prevention Week, which runs through Saturday, Ohio's suicide rate rose nearly 24% between 2008 and 2017. And Austin Lucas with the Ohio Suicide Prevention Foundation explains that social stigma still prevents people from seeking help. That's why he says it's crucial to discreetly reach out to loved ones who might be struggling and ask the question directly.
Are you thinking about killing yourself? Or are you thinking about suicide? And for a lot of people, that's really scary, especially if they are really close to this person because they're anxious that this person might say yes. However, having that conversation might be enough to save their life.
If the answer is yes, Lucas says the next step is to stay with them and help connect them to resources that can help. Anyone in crisis is encouraged to text 4-H-O-P-E to 741-741. Mary Sherman reporting. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 9th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's newscast is Claire Rosciotto, and our engineer is Jeff Henderson. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
I'm Ken Jones. Stay tuned for a live, in-depth, in-studio interview on KBOO's News in Depth with Sharon Dersey Martin, the principal at Lake Oswego's Harmony Academy.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A new sort of high school has opened in Oregon this school year, and it's a little bit different than traditional high schools. Harmony Academy Recovery High School is Oregon's first high school dedicated to helping students recovering from substance abuse disorders. The school is located in Lake Oswego on the old Merrillhurst University campus and is open to students in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. Today, we're very lucky to have Sharon Dersey Martin, the principal at Harmony Academy, with us. Sharon, welcome to the program. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here myself.
Yeah, so I have to tell you, we were doing a little research about this, and one of the things that I found amazingly overwhelming was the idea that Oregon ranks 48 out of 50 states. That's way low in providing this sort of resource for students that are struggling with substance abuse. And is this the first school of its kind? Exactly what is it that you do, and are you the first in this area?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are the first recovery high school in Oregon, although it is a model that's proving really successful around the country. To go back to your first question, what I'm hearing from parents a lot is that, you know, they identify that their student has a substance use disorder, but it's really, really difficult to access treatment. So when we say that we're 48th out of 50 in states, it's in terms of access to treatment. When a child decides that they want to seek treatment, that option should be available to them immediately.
And it's not at this point.
It's not. And I'm hearing from parents saying that they contacted law enforcement to try to get help for their child, that they contacted administration at their school and administration couldn't help. What they need is access to treatment.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of hoops they have to jump through, or is it just usually financially not feasible for them, or are there just not enough resources?
There's just not enough resources. And so parents with access, with more financial ability to pay, can access those resources more easily.
So how does Harmony School differ from a regular high school?
That's a great question. So what we have at Harmony Academy is we have a recovery coach as one of the foundational elements of the program. And so the recovery coach is there to help students overcome any obstacles to their education that might come up on a daily basis. So they can check in with that person who's also in recovery and say, I'm really feeling like getting high today and I'm not sure what to do. And he has the experience to walk them through that and to help connect them with their outside supports as well. So having access to that coach, and he leads a group every morning, that starts you off on the right foot in terms of thinking about recovery in a positive way that day. Even more important than that is what we call a positive peer culture. And that's that idea that everybody around you understands your struggles with substance use disorder, and they're also learning tools and ways of living in the world that are new and that are effective in staying clean and sober. And so that positive peer culture includes fun, it includes new ways of living, it includes just support from people that understand you. And we find that in the adult world, that's true too, that in recovery, identifying with other people with similar struggles and hearing how they're overcoming those struggles is the best weapon that we have.
So what I would want to know as a parent, I'm just on the other side of this, what I'd want to know is the education that you would get at Harmony Academy the same or comparable as they would get at another high school? Are there extracurricular activities? Is there a Harmony High School football team? Is there a pep squad? I'm sure there's not, but I'm being facetious here. But
it's
a
great question.
Yeah, but how does it compare to activities at a regular high school?
So I'll start off by saying that the diploma requirements are exactly the same, so we're not having a less than education. It's an enriched education. And in order to keep the interest of people who are struggling with substance use disorder, the academics absolutely have to be engaging. In terms of having, the ability to take up trumpet, we don't necessarily have that. But what we do have is students have access to their home district's resources for extracurriculars.
Oh, so it would be kind of like a homeschool in that same district. They'd be able to participate in a lot of the extracurricular activities
Absolutely.
Of that district. Okay.
So you could play football feasibly for your homeschool.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So they do have access to those.
They do.
And the educational requirements are exactly the same. Now, one of the things that is really helpful when a student comes to Harmony Academy is, like you mentioned, the support that they have, but also the fact that they have a network of peers now who are supporting their recovery. Can you talk a little bit about why that is so important? Because I know that the recidivism as far as backsliding into substance abuse again is much greater if they go immediately back to a regular school, correct?
Yep, that's absolutely true. Most students, when they get out of treatment, if they go back into the same environment that they were in, they'll relapse almost immediately. So having connection to peers who are on the same journey as you are is absolutely essential. And part of that is that addiction tends to be a disease that separates people from each other. And there's been a lot of studies that connection with others, deep connection with others, is actually very healing.
Well, having a connection, actually, I've heard is the cure.
You know,
as far as substance abuse is concerned, it's really one of the main keys to cure is having those connections. And especially when you're talking about teenagers for whom their peer group is almost as important, if not more important, than their family at that period
Absolutely.
In their life, right?
Absolutely.
So for you as an educator and as a principal and the teachers at your school, how does your job differ at Harmony Academy as compared to what it would be at a normal, I don't mean to say normal, that's really not the right right word, is it? Okay, so
in a typical,
there's the word I'm looking for. Thank you very much.
I think that connection piece is absolutely the answer to that question as well. I can't just be remote from the student body or from the staff. I really have to be in it. And I think that, I went to the Association of Recovery High Schools conference in Boston recently, and that's the number one thing that I heard is that everybody has to be in it in a very authentic, heart-led, people-first kind of way. So I think the answer to the question, the short answer is that the distance is the answer to that. You know, principals are in classrooms all the time, but I think that with the small student body that we have, it's really imperative that I build strong connections with the students and with their families.
That is really wonderful. Well, let's talk about scholastic success and educational mm-hmm. success. Do you find that students are more successful in their studies when they're involved in a school like this, a student that is struggling with substance abuse and into recovery? Do they do better in a school that supports them in this way? I mean, probably the answer would be yes, but how much better?
Well, the nationwide studies have shown that students that go to a recovery high school are actually more likely to graduate from high school than their peers at typical high schools. So that's great evidence, mm-hmm. I think. And I think, you know, just part of it is coming back from that situation of not being able to show up for yourself every day. In recovery, people can show up for themselves on a daily basis. And once somebody gets the feel of that success, and once they start sharing that success with the people around them, it's contagious. And it's a really, really positive feeling. And so we're hoping that the success that people get from connecting with their peers and from succeeding academically and from just reconnecting with their families and that kind of thing, that ends up being something that fills them up more than the substances could.
So in the first part of this interview, I was talking about how this was the only school, and you mentioned this is the only school in Oregon in the state that is a recovery high school.
Yep.
Obviously, there's a great need for there to be more of these sort of high schools and opportunities and support systems for students who are struggling with substance abuse. What is it going to take for us to have more support like this? And are there more schools planned at this point?
There is an organization called the Oregon Recovery High School Initiative, and they are the group that started Harmony, and they're working really hard to make sure that this opportunity is available for other students across the state.
Wonderful. So we can anticipate that there may be more high schools, recovery high schools in the future.
Absolutely. Academies. It's a successful model, and it's really needed. And I feel like we've gotten awesome support from all sorts of we've gotten from politicians, from the school board, from the medical field. I feel like everybody is at that moment right now where they're like, we don't want any more kids dying, and we know that this is successful in treating substance use disorder.
Wow. And I do want to talk to you just briefly before we go here. You're in that beautiful Merrillhurst building. That
it's
campus
so
is
beautiful.
So beautiful,
yeah.
There. Can you speak just briefly about how that happened, how you were able to get that building?
Oh, I wasn't with the group that secured this location, but I can tell you that the Christie School, what was called the Christie School, where we are right now, the Sisters of the Holy Names dedicated that building, that land that we're on, to only be used for students at risk, for youth at risk.
Oh.
And so it's got this beautiful history, and it just, you can feel the you know, just the positive intentions that were there.
Yeah, that is a wonderful story. Wow, I'm
yeah.
so glad that I asked that.
Yeah, thank you.
We have been talking with Sharon Dursey Martin. She is the principal of Harmony Academy, about the new Harmony Academy, the Harmony Academy Recovery High School on the old Merrillhurst campus. And we wish you much success. This sounds like an amazing undertaking, something that is definitely needed in this area.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me out.
Yep. And that is In Depth on KBOO Portland.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Stay tuned for Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Boys Who Said No, a documentary film screening on Saturday, September 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. During the Vietnam War, draft resistors openly refused military service to draw others to oppose the war. The Boys Who Said No is a documentary film featuring interviews with resistors and historians. Individuals featured include folk singer and activist Joan Baez, resistance leader David Harris, Cleveland Sellers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and Muhammad Ali. Again, that's The Boys Who Said No, screening